when I worked with Rex Stewart, he said, "How do you spell your name?" I said, L-A-C-K-R-I-T. He said, "I can't spell that. I'll call you Lacey."
Steve, welcome back to the Twin Cities. It's great to see you.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
Nice to see you. Mm-hmm. Well, today I'd like to talk about the evolution of your musical style, going way back to the earliest years. Mm-hmm. The first question I'd like to ask you has to do with something I read about when you were about 16 years old, picking up a beat up old clarinet and hanging out the window. On New Year's Eve. Can you talk about that a little bit and maybe about what motivation you think was behind that?
Well, I had been playing the piano sort of half-heartedly, or I had been trying to play the piano, but, you know, I started at the piano when I was a kid and went through the classical and the semi-classical and then finally discovered jazz in my early teens, and was trying to play jazz, was trying to improvise and all that, until I heard Art Tatum live when I was, I think, 13 or 14. My brother took me to Cafe Society downtown, and I heard Art Tatum twice. And at that point, I abandoned the piano. I gave up hope with the piano. I said, "Man, I'll never be able to play like that." Also, my hands were too small for the piano. I didn't have the hands for it, really. I just had no touch. So I was in more or less limbo, musical limbo, until I, by chance, that was about 13 or 14 or 15, no, 14 maybe, when I found an old clarinet, and I started fooling around with it, But at 16, I heard Bechet, and that was the beginning. When I heard Bechet's record of The Mooch, I realized that that was the way I wanted to go. That was the voice I was looking for. It was like I heard my own sound. And I heard the call. It was like the call. And that's how I found my calling, by responding to the call. And so I took a day job and saved some money and bought a soprano saxophone, which at that point nobody was playing, and it was either in pawn shops or just lying in dust, gathering dust in music shops. Nobody was playing the soprano, but I didn't know that. So I bought one and started to try and learn it myself, but I was getting nowhere, so I found a good teacher, Cecil Scott, and he took me under his wing and showed me the way, and that's how the whole thing began. But that was at the age of 16, really.
So you had an attraction, you know, as a young kid, as a junior high kid, you were listening to jazz on the radio, or was it walking past clubs living in Brooklyn?
You know, in New York at that time, there was jazz was in the air. Jazz was popular. People were dancing to it. It was on the radio. It was even in my apartment building. There were several people doing little jam sessions here and there, but I really discovered it myself in a record store. I think at 12 or maybe the age of 12, I was given some money for my birthday, and I decided to buy some records. And up to that point, the only records I had were classical records. But at that point, I went into a record shop and I looked around and I saw this album, Duke Ellington and His Famous Orchestra. Brunswick, an album of Brunswick records from the late 20s. And I looked at it, and I looked on the spine. It said, Duke Ellington and His Famous Orchestra. And I remember saying, well, why are they famous, you know? I was intrigued by that. I said, and I bought it blind. I bought it without listening to it or anything. I just, like, something instinctively told me, well, that's what I'll spend my money on. I'll buy this album. And that's how I really started on the whole jazz odyssey, really, was from that record, from those records. I just loved the stuff immediately, the so-called jungle band, and the Mooch was on there, so that I was primed. And then I started collecting jazz records and got into Louis Armstrong and all kinds of things. And so when I heard Bechet at the age of 16 playing the Mooch, there was this material click in that the material of the instrument, the saxophone, the soprano saxophone, and the material of the piece called the Mooch, that combination of material, it just bowled me over, really. That sound that Bechet got and playing that particular melody, it just got to me, man. It just, like, sent me.
You already knew the Mooch from the Ellington recording.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
So when I heard Bechet play it, I said, that was the click for me, really. It just, like, said, wow.
Now, were you acting completely alone, or did you have a circle of friends?
No.
No, this was just investigation.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, in school at that time, I was I think I was the only one really passionately interested in jazz. Really, nobody else. And in fact, I remember giving a lecture in front of my school, junior high, on the history of jazz. I still have the notes for that lecture somewhere. Really,
maybe you should publish it sometime.
No, it's just some, you know, amateur stuff.
Yeah, interesting.
There's enough bad critics around, you know.
But the best criticism is your own music, right? Your own work.
It was okay for a kid, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So I also read that you went to the Schillinger House in Boston.
Later on, yes, I did. I went to, it's called Berklee now.
Oh.
But at that time it was called Schillinger School of Music, and it was just small, maybe 75 people studying there. Now there's thousands and thousands of people. It's the same place. But they wouldn't accept me as a soprano student because the instrument didn't exist. So I had to, I chose an alto. I got an alto. And I went there and stayed for about 6 months. I hated it.
Now, was this in high school?
This was after.
After high school?
Yeah, okay. After high school. It was like a music college.
Okay.
But I didn't like the way they, it didn't seem to have anything to do with what I was interested in, really. But I did learn a few things up there. But I didn't like the way they taught harmony. They were using the Schillinger system, which is a mathematical system of writing music by mathematics. And I was just really fundamentally opposed to the whole thing. It just didn't. But in the evening, I would go and hang out at the clubs there, and that's when I heard the first modern jazz. That's when I heard Miles Davis group, for example. And that was an eye-opener, an ear-opener.
That would have been about 52 or 3
something
or so?
Something like that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I remember hearing Miles with Milt Jackson playing piano, Kenny Clark on drums, Percy Heath on bass, and Phil Urso on tenor. I mean, it's funny how you remember these things. This is like, you know, almost 50 years ago, but I remember it very well. I remember how exhilarated I was by the music, how I was struck. You know, and to me, like, the definition of jazz has always been something I never heard before, the music I never heard before that really knocked me out. So when I heard Ellington, when I heard Bechet, when I heard Miles and all the other people, that each time it was a thrill.
So then you moved back to New York after
that? I quit the school and moved back to New York and tried another school, Manhattan School of Music. And I didn't like that one either, really. So I had to, you know, I realized that school was not for me, that I wanted to learn, in real time, in real space with the musicians. And I was very, very, very lucky in the associations that I made in the 50s. My teacher, Cecil Scott, really opened the way for me and let me sit in with the groups that he was playing with, and I started working with all these traditional musicians from New Orleans, from Chicago, from Kansas City, who were all part of this so-called Dixieland concerts on weekends. There were two places in New York, the Stuyvesant Casino and the Central Plaza, and each one had two bands on Friday and Saturday, and they had all these great musicians playing there, really. And so I started. First, I was also into photography, and I was selling pictures of the musicians in order to get into the concerts. And that's how I met my teacher and all. And then I started sitting in with the bands, and then I started getting hired. The promoter called me the Bechet of today. It wasn't true at all. I couldn't hardly blow my nose at that point. But I was welcomed in those groups because nobody else was playing soprano. I didn't take anybody else's job away. They added me on. I was playing clarinet and soprano, but it was the soprano that was the thing, really. And then I started working with those musicians, with Rex Stewart, with Max Kaminsky, with Jimmy McPartlin, with Lips Page, with Red Allen, with all these fantastic musicians. And that's how I got my grounding, my schooling, really. It was much better than school.
Now, were you, what kind of approach, like you said, you didn't like the Schillinger system,
no.
You didn't like the Manhattan School of Music, but were you playing completely by ear, or were you analyzing tunes into the chord progressions?
I was trying to learn all the whole history of jazz. I was studying the whole history of jazz on records. I was learning the tunes. I was playing in these different styles. I was playing with the Chicago musicians, with the Kansas City musicians, with the New Orleans musicians. And they had a common repertoire of all these traditional songs, like Royal Garden Blues and Muscat Ramble and Tin Roof Blues and the Saints Go Marching In. There was I learned all those, and Honeysuckle Rose, all these standards. And because it was like that was what was going on. They were all playing this material, really, and so I learned all those things from my teacher, from records, and from actually doing it.
So when you say learned, though, are you talking about, obviously you're learning the melody, but would you think about the extensions on the chord progression?
Sure, I was into chords, I was into everything, but my teacher grounded me in various ways. He had me play strictly by ear, and he had me play strictly by notes also, so that I was learning to read a little bit and to go by ear and to know what the chords were and to know how to navigate musically all these structures, because that's what they were various structures to improvise on, themes. And so that was a good beginning, very good beginning.
And then you met Cecil.
Then Cecil plucked me out of there, really, and took me into his world, and I worked with him for 6 years, really.
How did that happen? How did you meet Cecil Taylor?
Well, I was sitting in one night at Jimmy Ryan's club with Don Fry, the piano player, and the trio. I was just sitting in with them playing some tunes, and Cecil came up to me and said, "How come a young fellow like you is playing this old music?" And that was a shock, really. I didn't think of myself as a young person, and I certainly didn't think of the music as old. So he said, "Why don't you come to my house, I have a rehearsal, and come in and play some." I said, "Okay." And I arrived at his house there, and there was Dennis Charles on drums, and I forget whether Buell Nyling was there already, but that was the basic quartet, was Dennis Charles, Buell, and myself, and Cecil. And in the course of the next 6 years, I worked with Cecil whenever he worked, which wasn't very often, but we rehearsed a lot, and we practiced all the time, and occasionally we got a gig, and then sometimes we played for dancing.
What was that like?
The first gig I ever played with Cecil was a dance at Columbia University, as far as I remember. And at that point, he had Callow Scott on cello and Cecil and myself. That's all. It was a trio. And, well, We were playing rumbas and mambos and blues, the minor blues, and standards, Duke Ellington tunes, Frank Sinatra tunes from movie, Deanna Durbin tune. He liked the, and he liked rather obscure standards, really, that nobody else was playing too much. And as long as we played for dancing, I mean, as long as the dancers kept dancing, we were okay. If we played the wrong thing and the dancers stopped dancing, we would get fired. So that was a very good education, too, and also that was the only jobs we could get at that point. Everybody was against Cecil. All the club owners and all the musicians and the critics and everybody was hostile to what Cecil was trying to do, except us in the band. And maybe two or three people that used to follow us around.
And this would have been 54 or 55?
Yeah, 56.
Into 56?
57, we finally got a chance to play at Newport in the afternoon. They put us on in the afternoon.
And how was that?
Well, I remember we got paid $50 for the whole quartet, including transport. And we were put on in the afternoon in this so-called avant-garde program, and well, the applause was lukewarm, tepid, really. The people went after we played, just like that. You know, it was really we were beyond the pale. I mean, to them,
because you were playing Cecil's music.
We were playing Cecil's music. We were playing his compositions and Johnny Come Lately and a blues. But there was one of Cecil's very complicated structures in there, too. I mean, he wrote, in those days, he wrote some very, very interesting pieces that were almost impossible to play technically, but that were very, very interesting to play upon structurally. And, well, the people were bewildered by what we were doing. And, of course, later that record came out of that, and it's a classic now. But at the time, it was really beyond the scope of most listeners. And the club owners were afraid that he'd break the piano. And the other musicians, almost all musicians were hostile to what he was doing. They said, well, this is not jazz, it's not piano playing, it's not music, it's not loud, it's, you know. The fundamentalists were dismayed.
So had you crossed over completely into Cecil's sphere, or were you also
playing? No, I was also playing traditional music. I was still working with some of the other people in the first few years anyway. And in 57, I started working with Gil Evans. And that was a very, very important episode, too. And also in 55, I discovered Monk's music, Thelonious Monk. And I started really learning, trying to learn his music, because it really interested me very, very much. So I was doing, and I was also studying Stravinsky, and later on Webern, and Schoenberg, and Prokofiev, and all the contemporary music, and also trying to learn harmony myself by studying Bach, the choral preludes. That's how I finally learned harmony, and it was from studying the choral preludes of Bach. All what I could never find in school was some exemplary structures to examine myself and to really learn the principles from the actual material rather than theory. I've always been against, not against, but it just... I don't want to know anything about theory. I'm a sort of anti-theoretical.
Well, how did your approach then apply to analyzing these pieces by Bach? Would you sit at the piano and...
I would sit at the piano and play them over and over again until I could hear them, until I could see them.
Mm-hmm.
I would play the music until I could see it. And, yeah, the piano was always very important to me, and it still is. And I spend much of my life at the piano, although not in public. But it's a laboratory for me, and that's how I learned harmony, and by learning Monk's music at the piano, and all the different material I was into, even Kurt Weill and all kinds of music. At the piano, I could study it myself. I didn't have to go to school and hear all these lectures about numbers and, you know, theories.
So your analysis proceeded more from a physical standpoint in that you were articulating the music with your hands and you were listening to the music.
Yeah.
But you weren't thinking about, again, perhaps the chord movement, or you weren't analyzing it in terms of the numbers.
Well, I was trying, you know, I would sit at the piano and I would play a chord and I would try everything with that chord, everything. And I would do all kinds of wrong things, too, and to see how they worked. I was very interested in what was considered wrong and breaking the rules and all that. I was really, you know, sort of a rebel and an iconoclast, and I wanted to try out stuff myself. And nobody was playing Monk's music, for example, and I couldn't ask anybody about that, and I had to learn the stuff from the records and try it out myself, and put it on my horn, and I was, you know, on my own, really, and what they call self-taught, really.
Right.
But I had all these wonderful associations with, you know, Cecil and Gil Evans and all the traditional players I played with, and then I was also playing with my own groups at that time, little trios and quartets, Benny Goodman-type things, playing standards with a guitar and bass and drums and, or vibes, various people in New York. And I was also playing Lester Lannan-type dance gigs.
I'm not familiar with him.
Well, there was a thing, they called them society gigs.
Yeah.
And there were dances, and you could have a fake book, and you played standards for dancing and medleys and things like that. And there were a lot of jazz musicians who were doing this, moonlighting like that, just to keep alive, to keep from working days. But I was also working days, because I couldn't make enough money in music, so I was working day jobs also for much of the 50s.
You must have been awfully busy.
I was very busy, yeah. I was trying to, you know, I was trying to learn everything, really. I was very, very eager. I was an eager beaver. I was trying to read and go to into painting, and Cecil turned me on to the dance world and politics and movies and all kinds of things, really. I was like, you know, it was a learning time. Those were the school days, really. But it wasn't from a normal school. It was like the University of Birdland, where I used to go and study the music. I would go there. It was very inexpensive. You could, for a dollar and a quarter, you could go to Birdland. And for 10 days in a row, you could hear like Duke Ellington's orchestra, Bud Powell Trio, Charlie Parker, Sarah Vaughan, all in the same bill. And you didn't even have to drink or anything. You could stay in the Peanut Gallery from 9 to 4 in the morning and study the music. I heard Lester Young and all kinds of stuff there, and I would just be there studying it, listening, steeping myself. And then eventually I got to play there myself with Gil Evans' band. And so I like to say I studied at the University of Birdland, really.